Welcome to the talk show dedicated to the wine industry. It's All About Wine. With your host, winemaker, cellar master, vineyardist, and tasting expert, Ron, Vice President and General Manager of Florida State's Winery in Land O'Lakes, Florida. Call our guest line at any time during the live show at area code 646-727-3235.
Basically, what we're trying to do on this program is educate people and make wine less confusing and more friendly.
Broadcasting on blogtalkradio.com from coast to coast.
Basser, Kansas.
Deming, New Mexico.
Ithaca, New York.
Knoxville.
Lancaster County, Pennsylvania.
Lexington, Kentucky.
Montana.
Moscow, Idaho.
New Hampshire.
New Mexico.
Santa Rosa.
Sevierville, Tennessee.
South Dakota.
The coast of Maine.
The Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
Westport, Mass.
You know, we really have had some neat people on the program. I love that. Alba Vineyards.
Blog.10Live.
Boyslip Winery.
Brotherhood.
Camas Prairie Winery.
Candia Vineyards.
Hello, the Burgesses.
Eagle Springs Winery.
Flathead Lake Winery.
Free the Grapes.
Grapesandwine.cal.cornell.edu.
Heritage Vineyards and Winery.
Hershey Harrisburg Wine Country.
Holyfield Vineyard and Winery.
Hummingbird Ridge Winery.
Toy Soy of Wine.
Prairie Berry.
Rainborn Wines.
Rocky Top Wine Trail.
Sheila Lauer Vineyards and Winery.
Southwest Wine.
Haber Hill.
Ten Spoon.
University of Kentucky Extension.
Vineyard at Hershey.
Vivac Winery.
Walt Vineyard.
Westport Rivers.
Wine Flower.
And around the world.
TheDriftingWinemaker.com. I just arrived in Bali about 3 days ago.
All About Wine is on.
If you have any questions or anything to talk about, we will be more than happy to talk to you about or search it for you or try to find information for you out there, because there is a lot of information out there about wine.
We do occasionally get off topic.
Belvoir Winery.
The most well-known haunted winery in the Midwest.
I've heard voices at the winery.
Call area code 646-727-3235 and let's talk about wine on air. And now, wine enthusiast and industry representatives, All About Wine is on. Here is your host, Ron.
Thank you, bus people. All right, nice and happy and warm and cozy and no rain and beautiful weather, and everybody, all the bus people are happy out there.
Yes, they are. And their temperature.
Yeah. It's mid-70s, upper 70s, and just absolutely wonderful, wonderful weather here in Florida, which is perfect weather for Saturday for our festival, which I'm sure Mike will tell you about later.
Make sure you can hear me. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Now I can, yes.
Oh, okay. No, something was... My audio was cutting out during the intro, and I don't know. You didn't hit any wires coming in, did you? You didn't hit anything coming in, did you?
I don't think I tripped over anything, no. I was pretty careful.
Yeah. Well, I heard your tires screeching when you came in the parking lot. That was...
I know. I was so late. I had to... Ran in and had to jump over a couple of the wires. I might have caught it with the corner of my surgical recovery shoe.
Still?
Yeah, I got it until Tuesday.
Wow.
They actually pull out the pin out of my toe and remove the... I've been calling it a boot. I just, my surgical boot. And I said that to the doctor when I went and saw her Tuesday. Tuesday. I said, my boot. She goes, she says, that's not a boot. She says, a boot is actually a boot. It fits all over your foot and partway up your leg and stuff like that, and that's a boot. She said, what you have on is a post-operative recovery shoe.
Okay, yeah.
So I have a post-operative recovery shoe on, and I will be happy to get my post-operative recovery shoe removed, which will be Tuesday, because that's the day they're pulling the pin out. And I said, what happens then? You pull the pin out, and then what happens? She says, whenever you feel you want to wear shoes, you can. So Tuesday.
So the So the pin is still inside your toe?
It is. It is.
Ow. And they're just going to, like, pull it out? That's it?
Yeah, I know. I've been thinking about that now, you know. And,
yeah.
That's... And not, yeah, you know, I'm getting a little apprehensive. As you know, I mean, it's Tuesday, but I'm already starting to get a little apprehensive because she says I'm going to pull the pin out. And I'm wondering, what do you do? Just take a needle nose and yank it right out? Or what, you know, what's going to go on with this? Huh?
Can you see it?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, is it
tip of the pin?
Oh, you can. Ooh.
Yeah.
Yeah, hope you don't have to go through more shots again.
No, if I do, I'm going to tell them to knock me out. I'm not going to go through that shot again.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was too much. No, it's I had an x-ray of my foot, and you can see the pin. It goes back to the back part of my toe. I had a bad hammer tone. What they did is straighten out and put the pin in there and just, you know, so it can start healing properly. But you can see the pin in the x-ray. She showed it to me. And it sticks out maybe a quarter of an inch, you know 5 millimeters out from the end. And it's got a little round head, like a push pin on the end of it. And
yeah, they need to put you out for that. That's going to you're going to feel
thinking,
that.
I'm thinking. Yeah. So, yes. I have to agree with you on that because I don't know what's going to happen when they pull this out. My son was telling me that it's a simple thing. They just slide the thing right out. But of course, it's very simple to tell people that.
Right.
But, you know,
they don't want to tell you the pain and everything.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, nobody told me about the shot either. So.
Gosh, I almost want to do a live show just to, Tuesday, just to cover this because I don't know if I can wait until next Thursday to hear about it. Let me set that up. Where's the create episode?
Well, I'll tell you though, I don't know. I don't know what to expect. She's going to pull the pin out now. Why? I don't know. Again, I become more and more apprehensive about it. Every time I start thinking about it, I'm saying, wait a minute, that pin has been in there pretty solid now for, well, it'll be 3 weeks. And now they're just going to take the thing and just pop it right out.
And it's never a big deal to them because they're the ones doing the pulling, not the,
Exactly.
Not my foot.
Now,
does that hurt?
Exactly. It's like the dentist. Oh, this is going to hurt just a little. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Or getting a shot. Oh, you'll feel a little sting. Yeah, okay.
But at least you get to wear regular shoes and you'll be back to normal and after Tuesday, good.
I'll get back, be able to start playing golf again, with this beautiful weather here. It's just great for golf and all that.
That was perfect.
So, yeah.
Good time to be outside.
So I'm looking forward to that. You know, being able to actually take a shower without having to put a bag around my foot and tie a towel around my ankle before I put the bag on and then put the rubber bands on the top, tie the bag, and
Oh, my gosh.
I know. It's such a pain. It really is.
Just
so
want to be normal just for once.
All,
be normal. It's been 3 weeks.
It's been 3 weeks. And I just want to be normal. With my sympathies out for all those out there who have disabilities and stuff, I mean, I really do. I have grown a great new respect for disabilities and stuff like that. So, but hope everyone had a good, speaking of disabilities, a good Veterans Day yesterday. All those who are veterans, again, thank you for your service, and hope you all had a good day or remembered all of our veterans and everything. I was just saying, what we got? We don't have any more holidays coming up, do we? I mean, these holidays are always a good excuse to open up a bottle of wine. And
26 is a big wine day. Yeah.
Which one?
26, isn't it? Isn't
that
the last Thursday of the month?
Yes. Yeah, 2 weeks.
Big wine day. Yep.
Big wine day.
Every day should be a big wine day, but, that's the big bun day. Yes.
But, now you can think of an excuse that it's even better. We've been talking about craft breweries off and on and how they're exploding and how they're actually taking off all over the country. I want to read a little something here and share a little something. This is out of Wine and Craft Beverage News. It's a publication I've been getting ever since they started. I love this little magazine. It comes out of, I don't know where, New York, I believe, yeah, New York. And they started out calling it Wine Beverage News. And it just, has different ads in it, different articles about wine, all that. Then it became a special section in it for craft beer. And now they've changed the name to Wine and Craft Beverage News. So it's a lot of different things in here about craft beverages, not just beer, but, you know, some spirits and stuff, cideries and meaderies and stuff. But this is interesting. It says the Brewer Association reports big gains for small and independent brewers. And this is an article out of Boulder, Colorado. It says the craft brewing industry has continued a strong pace of growth in the first half of 2015, according to the data recently released by the Brewers Association, which is the not-for-profit trade association for the American craft brewers. The production volume has increased 16% during the first half of the year. From January to the end of June 2015, approximately 12.2 million barrels of beer were sold by craft brewers. Now, this isn't the biggies. This isn't InBev and Miller, SAB, and all these others. This is the little small ones that are popping up all over the country. Industry growth is occurring in all regions and is stemming from a mix of sources, including various retail settings and a variety of unique brewery business models, said the chief economist Bart Watson from the Brewers Association. He said the continued growth of small and independent breweries illustrates the additional market opportunities that are prevalent, and even though the competition is out in different sectors, it is still growing by leaps and bounds to show that we're producing world-class, high-quality beer. As of June 30th, 2015, there were 3,739 breweries operating in the United States. There are, at this time, an additional 1,755 brewers in planning. And currently, they employed an estimated 115,469 full-time and part-time workers, which also includes manufacturing jobs and all aspects of the brewery. More and more Americans are discovering the joys of enjoying fresh beer produced by their neighborhood brewery. By supporting local, small, and independent craft breweries, beer lovers are gradually returning to the United States to the system of localized beer production that existed for much of our nation's history, said Bart Watson. So, 2011, 5.5 million barrels of beer craft breweries produced, 5.5 million barrels. 2012, it jumped to 6.4. 2013, 7.3 million barrels. 2014, 10.6. And so far in 2015, 12.2 million barrels of beer have been sold by craft brewers. The number of breweries in the country in 2011 were 1,776. 1776. Oh, that's cool. That was an increase of 151 over the previous year. The next year, in 2012, it grew by 350 up to 2,126. 2013, 412 new ones opened for a total of 2,538. 2014, another 502 craft breweries opened for a total of 3,040. And then so far in 2015, like I just read, 3,739 breweries are operating in the United States now. That's an increase of 699, just almost 700 over last year. And 1755 are in planning stages. So it's exploding. This craft brewery stuff is exploding. I mean, somebody out there, if you're into the craft breweries, you can get yourself a program all about craft beer. And be on, no, not Thursday night at 7, but you can, you know, a good opportunity for something there to check out. So I just saw that. I want to share that because we've mentioned craft breweries quite a few times during the shows, and there was just some phenomenal numbers there that I wanted to pass on. Something else I wanted to do. I don't know. I can't remember if I talked about this or not. I really, really am. Let's see. Oh, here it is. This is Paints from Vineyards. I think I may have talked about this. I'm not sure if I have. I asked my engineer, do you remember if I talked about different paints from vineyards? Yeah. This, I don't think so either. Okay, good. This is out of Winemakers Quarterly. It's another publication that I receive, and it's just got some good information. It's a little bit more technical. It is it's from a lab that sends this out and takes care of this, and because it's from a lab, they go a little bit more technical, but I'm not going to, I'm going to try to keep it because, you don't need to know the technical. You probably don't care. But there's some interesting things. They had listed four things here that could affect wine. And some of these originate in the vineyards. While not all the taints are undesirable, to know what you're getting and what you're tasting and smelling and all that is important because it can affect the wine. So, and the first one they list here is smoke taint. And we've talked about this on previous shows about what smoke taint is doing and all that. Speaking of which, the big fire in California has been completely cleaned up, completely taken care of. Mike just left me. Huh. Well, he was dropped. I don't think he left on purpose. I think it looks like he might be having problems. So I'm sure he'll be back joining us pretty soon here. But it happens. I had trouble getting on the switchboard myself. Oh, there he is. He's back with us.
Yeah, just all of a sudden, boop, okay.
I thought maybe you had to go to a potty break or something.
No, I take the computer with me.
Oh. I looked up and you were gone, and I'm going, oh.
Yeah, I was just writing smoke taint, and then I heard the little Skype beep, and I go, what? So, had to get that fixed.
I had trouble getting on tonight, too. Maybe it's something with Skype. I don't know. Smoke taint. Like I said, we've talked about this before. Smoke taint is caused by smoke compounds. Mainly, it's volatile phenols, which are absorbed by the vines and end up in the wine. Now, what happens is it's absorbed by the vines all over. I've read other places where it's just they absorbed by the grapes, but actually it gets into the vines themselves. That's why, it could happen any time during the growth of the grape if you get smoke in the areas and stuff. Research in Australia is showing that the smoke phenols, once absorbed by vines, are largely bound to sugars. So there you go. I mean, this is, and that's what you're looking for in the grapes. It's difficult to detect the smoke taint because it renders the smoke phenols are odorless. So you really can't pick it up and smell it. And so it, really in the grapes, it goes basically unnoticed. During fermentation is where some of it comes back, and that's where you start getting the odors. Laboratory analysts can measure trace levels of the smoke taint at levels below the century threshold. So that gives winemakers an opportunity to be able to have it tested if they think they're going to have a problem. But smoke phenols readily transfer from grape skins and vine MOG, or material other than grape, into the juice and fermentation. So to stop this, white wines, you try to minimize the skin contact with the juice, and so that's going to cut back on it there. And skin contact with the red is not always practical, so you have to look for other ways to do it. And the article says that it's not really a lot of options. They're very limited and often disappointing. They said when smoke taint is suspected in a wine, determination of, well, there's, you know, different levels of things you can do, and you can detect the taint and its intensity. Baseline levels of these compounds will give you a starting point for comparison with other treatments and allow you to do what you can to do it, but it's not always able to completely eliminate it in certain red wines. And so that's one of the things that can happen in red wines, or in wines, the smoke taint. And since there's been an issue in California and Australia and other places, actually, IBMP. This is 2-isobutyl-3-methoxyprobazine. This is the main compound that you'll find in wines that give the green bell pepper aroma. In Sauvignon Blanc, that compound adds you the grassy character. If you're a Sauvignon Blanc drinker and you pick up a grassiness. Now, Sauvignon Blancs, I pick up more from New Zealand Sauvignon Blancs and the classic grassy flavors and aromas than I do in most anywhere else in the world. I don't know why, but just Sauvignon Blanc from New Zealand seems to, for some reason, bring it out better to me. But the IBMP is the compound that gives you that. In red wines, it's not a good thing. This is really an unpopular thing to pick it up in red wines. Excessive levels of IBMP in red wines, particularly Cabernets and Cabernet-based blends, can actually lower scores and lead to disappointing aromas and taste. So because the levels typically decrease as grapes mature, you have to monitor the ripening, and that gives the winemaker a unique tool to assess what they call the aromatic maturity, along with the berry maturity, to be sure that it's not picking up any IBMP. Again, 2-isobutyl, I-S-O-B-U-T-Y-L, isobutyl, it's 2-, isobutyl dash 3, the number, dash, methoxypyrazine, and that's methoxypyrazine. So if you want to look that up, it's believed that IBMP, which is much easier to say than the other long word, decreased during ripening. It is caused by an active metabolic process instead of just being out in the sun and being degraded by the sunlight. There's a strong evidence that a severe heat stress can trigger maturity stops, where the IBMP suddenly stops degrading. And this can result in shriveled, high-brix, raisiny grapes with concentrations of IBMP, which gives you a combination of green, herbaceous, unripe, or jammy, overripe flavors, depending on when it's picked. You monitor the grapes in all the stages, and it should not give you too much trouble. Certain trellis management systems will be better, along with fertilization and early leaf removal, and all this stuff can have an impact on IBMP in the vineyard. Testing it right before harvest is a useful tool, and it's easy to do. There are some hidden sources of IBMP, but most of the time it can be tested, and you can work with it and get it out of the final product. So IBMP, good for Sauvignon Blanc, bad for red wines, particularly Cabernets. Eucalyptol. Now, this is something people, eucalyptol. Eucalyptol character is one of the industry's most controversial aromas. I really detected that on some wines, too. I'm sure you have if you've had some, especially Australian wines or in New Zealand or stuff like that. On one hand, eucalyptol traits are considered desirable in cult wines. Again, Australian stuff. And in excess, that can be overwhelming, which I've had some that were quite overwhelming. ETS researched this, and ETS is the name of this company that does labs. ETS researched eucalyptol, which is actually written as 1-8 or 1-8. -CINEOLE, Cinenol, in wine, and discovered that airborne transfer from eucalyptus trees growing near vineyards to the grape berries, again, from Australia and New Zealand. Eucalyptol can adhere to the wax on berry surfaces and is then transferred into the wine during macerations and fermentations. The character is rarely found in white wines due to the minimal skin contact. Australian Wine Research Institute also found that eucalyptol can be transferred to vine leaves and material other than grape and from eucalyptus leaves and nuts that may end up in harvested grapes. So as you're picking them and getting different stuff or even machine picking. Flavors perceived during tasting change with varying concentrations. Trace levels close to 1 part per billion are associated with fresh, slightly minty notes. In large part per billion range, minty or fresh bay leaf aromas become stronger and are easily identifiable as eucalyptus as concentrations increase. With wine with strong eucalyptus odors may contain more than 20 parts per billion of eucalyptol. There's analysts that you can do to, winemakers can do to analyze this to see what levels are in their grapes. And it can also be used to assess the impact of eucalyptus trees near the vineyard and influence of the practice at sorting and harvest. So that's another one, eucalyptus, that's what that's from. But you can look for those things. And then the last one they say here, things that you get, invasive insects. Now, this is something you don't think about too often when you're out there and you pop open a bottle of wine and what it's going to do for you, how it's going to taste. But ladybug paint first came to light in Ontario in 2001. An offensive off aromas, often described as being vegetal or peanut, bell pepper, or asparagus, were often noted in wines following a population explosion of multicolored Asian ladybug or lady beetles. Well, ladybugs, high volumes, but actually technically lady beetles. Originally introduced for biocontrol of aphids. So you throw the ladybugs out there for biocontrol and they explode and you start getting a problem there. Researchers at Brock University in Ontario traced the off aromas to IPMP. We just introduced you to the IBMP, but IPMP is different. Instead of 2-isobutyl, this is 2-isopropyl, 3-methoxypyrazine. So that's your technical thing. Excuse me. released by the ladybugs when they were crushed during the winemaking process. So this is what they do. The ladybugs give you the IPMB when they're crushed. As little as one lady beetle per vine may be sufficient to taint the wine. Wow. Ladybug taint appears to be a recurring problem on the east coast of the U.S., but not so far has not had a significant impact on the west coast. Another insect, the brown marmorated stink bug, shortened to BMSB, is an exotic species native to Asia that is now found in most of the U.S. population and has been established in Washington, Oregon, and some in California. There's concerns that the odor compounds released by these bugs may also taint wine. These are identified in 2012 as unsaturated aldehydes. University of Maryland did this, which gives you what they call a skunky or a citrusy or a piney odor, reminiscent of fresh cilantro. Preliminary research at Oregon State University in 2013 suggests that wines may become tainted at an infestation level of only a couple of bugs per vine. There is concern that a Pinot Noir might be especially susceptible to the taint from the brown marmorated stink bug. So, things that can affect wines. There's four more of them for you that we probably never really looked at or never really considered, but now you can pick up a wine from an area and all that, and you go, what's that? And maybe you can say, well, that could be a ladybug crushed in my wine. So, I don't know. There's always something that we have to watch for when we're making wines and looking at wines and trying to get them out there so you will enjoy them. So, all right. Some other things this evening for you. Did you... Was that you that made a noise, or was that me? Well, that must have been me.
No.
Remember, oh, geez, what was it, 6 months ago, I guess, has been when they came out with that big thing about arsenic in wine and how the levels of arsenic are so bad and, you know, it's higher than anything else. So I got a couple articles here. I want to talk about the arsenic issue one last time because it's in unless the lawsuit that they started goes any further, but excuse me. Wine. I can't take a sip of wine because I don't have a sip of wine tonight. The body representing California winemakers has refuted the claims made by the study that was released about the dangerous levels of arsenic in the wine. And you know, I think I told you that when I went on there. In a statement that was titled, How Worried or Not Worried Should People Be Over Arsenic in the Wine?, the trade body said, all wines sold in the United States are completely safe and consumers should have no concerns about enjoying them. Now, this came after a study by the University of Washington, and I'll get into that study shortly here and tell you a little bit more about it. But the University of Washington did a study of California, Washington State, Oregon, and New York wines. The study found levels of poisonous substance that exceeded the maximum permitted in drinking water in 64 to 65 wines tested, and some of them were greatly exceeding this limit. The wine sample showed arsenic levels ranging from 10 to 76 parts per billion, with an average of 24 parts per billion. The Environmental Protection Agency allows drinking water to contain no more than 10 parts per million. However, the Wine Institute of California has called the study an example of propaganda, which is designed to support financially motivated litigation. And the Wine Institute of California argued that authorities in the U.S., Canada, Europe regularly test wines for harmful compounds and ensure that all wine is safe to consume. He said the methodology of the study is in question. And arsenic is a naturally occurring element that is toxic to humans, can cause skin, lung, and bladder cancers, as well as other life-threatening diseases. But it is in everything and all stuff that we consume to some levels. And it just, it's basically, they're saying that, you know, forget it, it's ridiculous. Why even waste your time on this? There was no, here, let me just wipe this out and go to this next one here. Now, this next one here is from the University of Washington. This is the actual information that was originally published here. And it said a companion study concluded that the likely health risk from the naturally occurring toxic element depends on how many other foods and beverages known to be high in arsenic, such as apple juice, rice, or cereal bars, an individual person eats. The highest risk from arsenic exposure stem from certain types of infant formulas, the study estimated. So, yes, they did find levels of arsenic, but it wasn't just in that. And it wasn't, there was another lab, I believe, in Denver that picked up the study and ran with it and started to sue and stuff like this. But the original study went on to say consumers need to look at their whole diets. And if you're eating a lot of contaminated rice, organic brown rice syrup, seafood, wine, apple juice, all these are heavy contributors to arsenic poisoning. And this is especially of concern if you're pregnant, to kids, and to the elderly. So it became, you know, it's, the rest of the studies came out. Arsenic is a naturally occurring element that is toxic to humans in some form. As rain, rivers, and wind erode rocks that contain arsenic, it leaches into the soil and the water and stuff, and then it picks it up and puts it in the food chain, which, you know, so many things do. The study looked at red wines, except from two areas in Washington where only white wines were produced, because they made they are made with the skin, and that's where the arsenic was picked up more so than anything, into the skins. They tested for lead also, which is was also found, and they found, study found that 58% of the samples, only 5% from New York, exceeding drinking water standards. Washington wines had the highest arsenic concentrations at 28 parts per billion, while Oregon had the lowest, averaging 13 parts per billion. And there is no statistical difference, they said. The only star in the story is Oregon, where arsenic concentration was particularly low. Where arsenic levels were particularly low. Because the average adult drinks far more water than even core frequent wine drinkers, it's an imperfect comparison. Average adult drinks 1.7 to 3.2 cups of water per day, whereas the average wine drinker drinks about a half a cup per day. Now, this is average. I mean, you know, I have people come in all the time saying, ooh, much, much more than that, but, you know, average. So it's an uneven balance here. I mean, drinking water, 10 parts per billion, but then you multiply that times 3.2 as opposed to a half a cup, and you're within the safety range. A companion study compiled data for foods that have been shown to contain arsenic. These were juice, milk, bottled water, wine, cereal bars, infant formula, rice, salmon, and tuna. Now, the average dose that arsenic of an average child or adult would get would form more of a risk than just wine. And the frequent wine drinker would make up only about 10 to 12% of the total maximum recommended daily arsenic intake. Say, for example, a person who eats an average or large amount of contaminated rice would get between 41 and 101% of maximum recommended daily arsenic. The study found also a child who drinks apple juice could get a quarter of the maximum daily arsenic dose from that single source. So this arsenic in wine thing, if you start looking at the whole thing, it really starts becoming, I mean, the study went into this other. The biggest thing here, and the biggest one of all this, and it said, rather than litigate against vineyards, as some people have done, they would encourage consumers to evaluate their diets and speak with a doctor if they have concerns. Tests are available to detect high arsenic levels, and then that way you can see if you are putting too much arsenic in your body, but it's not usually from wine. Wilson, who did this study here, let me see her first name. I can't find it right now. Denise Wilson, who is an engineering professor who was the lead on the study. Denise Wilson said, my goal is to get people away from asking the question, who do we blame? And instead offer consumers a better understanding of what they're ingesting and what they can do about their diets. Now, the thing of this whole thing that concerned me more than anything else was, you know, they were talking about all the different things that could make arsenic higher in your body. But the thing that concerned me was rice, okay? The adult female eating rice can get 101% of the recommended amount a day. That's maximum. But this is what really got me. Formula. Infant's formula. There is, they show formula 1, formula 2, and formula 3, and they didn't break it down to what it was or anything. But formula 1, formula 2, and formula 3. Formula 1, maximum levels of arsenic, 51%. Formula 2, 442%. Formula 3, 1,040% of the maximum arsenic recommended for infants. Wow. I mean, you know, if you want to throw your hands up and start getting on a bandwagon, let's start looking at formulas and stuff like that. I am older and I am not around infants, although I have a new infant being born into the family. My son's wife is pregnant, but geez, if 1,000+% arsenic maximum is scary. It really is. Wine, an adult female maximum level is 12%. Adult male maximum level is 10%. I mean, it's insignificant, really. Rice, 101%, and females, 85% males. Cereal bars, 31% female, 27% males. So, if you're concerned about arsenic in wine, then watch everything. Tuna, 6.1% and 5.2% in males. It's, you know, cereal bars are outrageous, and rice and all this stuff. So, you know, again, this is the last thing where I think we're going to need to be talking about arsenic in wines, because the level is really, really so insignificant that it's not going to make a difference to anyone about anything, unless you're eating a whole bunch of rice and sucking down baby formula at the same time. And then you might be a little concerned about your rice or about your arsenic consumption. We're done with that then. New grape varieties in Iowa. Eastern Iowa. I got a blank now. What's the name of the winery in Eastern Iowa that I visited? Can't think of it. But they use some of these grapes here. Wineries are starting to explode in that part of the country. The French California grapes don't really grow there because they can't handle the frigid winter. Marcel Foch can endure the cold weather, but you know, Cabernet, a Cabernet Sauvignon grape if it drops below 20 degrees, minus 20 degrees Fahrenheit, for up to 2 hours, it will freeze the grape internally, the vine internally, and it won't recover. It'll die. It's too much for it. And most of the ones from France and California and all that are that way. So they have been looking at new cold hardy grapes. The Elmer Swinson, I've mentioned his name before in previous shows, was a pioneer in breeding cold hardy grapes starting back in the 1940s. And he's produced some new varietals that became commercial wines in starting in the 70s and 80s. University of Minnesota has since came out with the Frontenac grape in 1996, the La Crescent grape in 2002, the Frontenac Gris in 2003, and the Marquette grape in 2006. And so these are ones that are new that are taking off in that part of the country, in Iowa particularly. But they say that they need to get people familiar with these grapes. You don't walk into a store and ask, do you have a La Crescent wine available or a Frontenac? It's something that we don't know and we aren't familiar with. So it's a matter of training people and looking at it. There are going to be some good quality grapes, but not the same as California. Excuse me, well, I got a scratchy throat tonight. I apologize. They're going to be different. Midwest white wines can have a much fruitier characteristic and hints of apricot and peach. The Brianna grape is also grown in the Midwest, has tropical fruit flavors such as pineapple, which I'm not familiar with the Brianna grape, but that sounds interesting. Midwestern wines are often tart compared to their traditional counterparts. This is according to Doug Frost, who is a master sommelier and master of wine based in Kansas City, Missouri. They have fewer tannins, and it could appeal to drinkers who find the tannins to be bitter or astringent and stuff like that. A lot of people come in and don't like tannins. They just don't like that taste. And so these Midwest grapes could be an alternative for those who are not into the tannins. Another quirk of the Midwest grapes is that they behave differently in the bottle. They should be consumed within a year or two of their vintage. Don't try to age them. In fact, don't try to age most any of the wines that you'll buy unless you actually know that they're going to age. They are working on it and trying to improve the grapes. The Marquette, they said, is going to be a good grape. It's got the potentials of really developing into a very nice grape. The availability, though, is a little bit lacking from what they're doing. They're not planting as much. Technical help, the Iowa Wine Growers Association is getting support from Iowa State University and provides the growers with some technical support, which is helping a lot. And a lot of Iowa's community colleges have extensions that are also helping them. They're starting new wineries using just these cold hardy grapes. Last year wasn't a real good year because of the weather, heavy rains early on, which caused some problems. But they said that they looked at getting a lot of these grapes out there and getting people more familiar with them. So what is the name of that? I know it. I get e-letters from them and flyers a couple times a year. But new grapes, look for them. Look for them in the stores. I don't know if a lot of them. Total Wines might have some of those and stuff. And if you live in the Midwest and areas there, then grab them. It's something that could open up a whole new world for you there. One of the things that I'm always telling people when I do tastings is when I do the Chardonnay, I see. Chardonnays go great with just about everything. You can find a style of Chardonnay to match up with just about any type of food you want to put on the table. Because of that, Chardonnay is the number one selling wine in this country. And it has been. It has been for a long, long time. Everybody makes Chardonnay. You look at the wineries we've talked to, and most everybody has a Chardonnay. If they don't grow it, then they get it in so they can have a Chardonnay. And Chardonnays are made in all sorts of styles. An oaky style, a buttery style, an oaky and buttery style, a non-oak, a sweeter styles, a very dry styles. Chardonnays are very versatile and very hearty out there. And people are big, big fans of Chardonnays, or they're not a fan at all. You know, ABC, anything but Chardonnay movement, ABC. And I have people come in and mention that to me. Or ABC could be anything but Cabernet. Some people have said that. But over the last year, the volume of Cabernet Sauvignon sold off-premise grew by 4.8% compared to a 0.7% growth for Chardonnay, which Chardonnay has been the biggest varietal wine for decades, but it might have its dominance threatened now by Cabernet. Cabernet Sauvignon. If Cabernet Sauvignon and Chardonnay continues to grow at current rates, Cabernet will be the biggest variety in 3 years, as predicted by Brian Lackner, who's the vice president and group client director at Nielsen. And yes, the Nielsen group we're familiar with. He attributes the advantage of Cabernet to a shift in generational behavior. Says Gen X wine drinkers tended to enter the category of white wines. Millennials are more likely to enter in the red wine category. I don't know. The cross-sections I see coming in the winery, I question that it would make a big difference. I don't see it. I do, but not enough to screw the numbers that way. Consumers continue to spend more on wine and more per bottle. Nielsen's off-premise report shows a 4.5% growth in dollars spent on wine over the last year. But the trend is even stronger over the last quarter. 5.7% growth over the last quarter. And the last month has jumped up 6.5%. People have more discretionary money now. And it goes back to the wine. This is something we've always said in the business. You know, this is a discretionary thing. You don't have to have wine. But now that people do have money, they're starting to spend more on wine, finding the good stuff with it. Margin of price range, $9 and up, showing some growth, but the biggest margin is the $15 to $20 segment. That grew by over 15% this past year. So people are buying a little bit better wines, and if they're not, they're getting more of it. Category seeing growth is the blended reds. Now, that's something that I believe. A lot of people are coming and telling me how much they enjoy the blended reds. They said that this is one of the biggest growth categories, 9% growth in the blended reds. The three biggest varietal losers in annual dollar sales is Syrah, dropping 10.9%, almost 11%. With white Zinfandel dropping 6.2%. Although I think part of that might be white Merlot is stepping in there. But then number three, Merlot has dropped 3%. So I'm curious to break that down into the two categories of white Merlot and Merlot to see how that might be affecting. But those are the three categories in decline. Australian wines in the U.S. markets continue to decline, but it looks like it might be slowing down. It dropped 5.5%. year over year, but the quarter has dropped only 2.7%. So it might be getting stronger there. But Cabernet Sauvignon is strong, strong showing and being contributed to the millennials. So I don't know. It's something that I don't know if I'd really totally agree with. But hey, you know, the guy's an expert. I'm not.
Let's see. And I've got one more thing. Do I? No, I don't. Good, because it's time for Mike to tell us about all the stuff we have scheduled for this weekend.
Yeah, you have a couple of things. I can hear myself on your speaker.
Can you?
I can. Yes.
Oh, I got my microphone, my headset's on, and my microphone on, then you're coming through the speakers
wow.
here.
I heard it almost like I was, the speakers were in here. That's all right. let's see. Yes, you do have, let me scroll down here. You do have a few things going on this weekend. We'll start with what's going on Saturday. It's that time. It is Wine Fest this Saturday. That's November the 14th, 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. And we'll tell you a little bit about it right now. Don't go anywhere.
Coming up this Saturday at Florida Estates Winery, it's Wine Fest, 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. Enjoy live music, have a little fun, and shop our vendors providing unique handmade items and some brand names you have known for years. Participate in an informative wine tasting with wine expert and show host, Ron. Sample some of Florida Estates Winery's world-class wines. Shopping is always fun, and Wine Fest is a great way to pick up unique gift items. Come out to Florida Estates Winery and enjoy the weekend with us. Listen to live music and shop under the giant oak trees while enjoying a glass of your favorite wine. This is a family event, and pets are welcome at Florida Estates Winery. See you there. Florida Estates Winery is located at 25241 State Road 52 in Land O'Lakes, Florida. Call 813-996-2113 or email corp@flune.com. That's corp@flewn.com for more information. Florida Estates Winery is open daily, 11 a.m. to 6 p.m.
Nice. Boom. Wow. Wow, that was a lot of explosion there. Come on out and enjoy. The weather is going to be beautiful. I think we have a cold front coming through. It's going to be a little cooler than usual, but nothing like what they're experiencing up in the north and everywhere else but Florida. So lots of sunshine. It's going to be great. Come down, stop at the winery, enjoy Saturday, and you have something going on Sunday. And then after you're done there, you can head out to the beach and enjoy it. There's no snow here, so don't worry about it. Music entertainment for Saturday is Patrick Foy, and he'll be out there at the winery under the oak trees. It's just a great casual setting. I mean, it's, you know, you don't have to wear a suit or anything. It's family friendly, and you can come
pet
out
friendly.
And just enjoy the day and relax. Pet friendly, that's right. You know that.
Yeah.
And a lot of vendors are on board to, you can shop with and don't forget that holidays are right around the corner, and pick up unique items for family members, friends, and your pets, and enjoy it. Now's the time to do it. And you got all kinds of things going on here. Come on out. Shopping is always fun, and that is at Florida Estates Winery on November 14th, this Saturday, from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. And Sunday, this is still
Sunday,
on, I believe.
Sunday. Yes.
Yeah. Sunday. Wine class, 3 hours. It's 1 p.m. to 4 p.m. That is a wine class this Sunday. That's November 15th. Hold on just a second. I think I have, hang on. I'll be right back.
Hey, this is Mike. Coming up this Sunday at Florida Estates Winery from 1 p.m. to 4 p.m. is another wine class. That's right. Wine class at Florida Estates Winery featuring winemaker, vineyardist, cellar master, and tasting expert Ron Hunt. He shares his experiences and educational knowledge of wine in a detailed 3-hour wine class. It's a lot of fun and a great way to learn something new about wine. Some of the topics that are covered include a brief history of wines, wine grape varietals, wine grape diseases, wine glass styles and uses, cork history, evolution and uses, oak aging, wine tasting and rating wines, and my favorite, of course, the sampling of wines and a discussion. It's a great presentation, and it's located in the Florida Estates Winery Tasting Room. For more information and to RSVP, which we would recommend, please contact the winery at area code 813-996-2113. Again, Florida State's Winery is phone number 813-996-2113. Florida State's Winery is located at 25241 State Road 52 in Land O'Lakes, Florida. Don't forget wine class this Sunday from 1 p.m. to 4 p.m. at Florida State's Winery. See you there.
No yep. Explosions. Okay. Yeah, so come on out, and you have a wine fest Saturday, wine class on Sunday. You are busy, and we're getting into that holiday season, and it's going to be great out there. So come on out, and yeah, very, very good, friendly atmosphere, and check it out if you haven't been. So that'd be great. Also, if you're in the area, there's also a tip jar up at the counter. We'd love for you to stop by and add a little something to the tip jar during your visit. It's always appreciated, and it goes to a good cause. This month, the tip jar goes to Raffle Rescue, and they do what they can to keep your pets in your home if you're having a financial crisis and cannot afford the cost of a pet. Things happen, and Raffle Rescue helps you and your pets by keeping them with you, and it's a great organization. Also, if you bring in a donation of pet food for Raffle Rescue, you get a 10% discount on your wine purchase. So that's going to be awesome. Yeah, and come on out. So it's the holiday season's coming up, and you know, wine is always welcomed, and never returned and never regifted. People consume it. So come on out and pick up a good bottle of wine at Florida State's Winery. Really good stuff. So check it out. 25241 State Road 52 in Land O'Lakes, Florida. It's about 4 miles west of I-75 on State Road 52. So check it out. And I guess that is all we have. So
yeah, we'll see you Saturday and or Sunday.
Yes. I was looking at the date. I go, what, next Thursday, Saturday? No. Yeah, okay. I see what you did there. So, yes, come out to the winery this Saturday or Sunday and for the events. It's always great. All right, we will talk to you again. And hopefully, you know, if you want to call us in, you can always do that during the show. We'll see you back here on Blog Talk Radio on next Thursday. It's November 19th. Right here at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and you can like the show on Facebook and also on Twitter. Just look for All About Wine or All About Wine BTR, and that's for Blog Talk Radio. So check it out, and we'll see you all next time. Thanks for tuning in, and
thanks for listening.
Glad you
can
make it.
Enjoy some wine. We'll see you next week.
Yeah. Yes, drink wine. Yeah, we'll see you next time. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you.
This concludes tonight's broadcast of All About Wine with your host, Ron, Vice President and General Manager of Florida State's Winery. Florida State's Winery is located at 25241 State Road 52 in Land O'Lakes, Florida, 4 miles west of Interstate 75 or east of US 19 and US 41. For more information on Florida State's Winery, visit the website at floridaestateswines.com or call area code 813-996-2113. The email address is corp@floon.com. That's corp@floon.com. For more information on All About Wine and future shows, please like us on Facebook at facebook.com/allaboutwineBTR or visit our website at allaboutwinebtr.com. Archived shows are available as a free download on iTunes and on our show page at blogtalkradio.com/allaboutwine. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next time on All About Wine.